Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Hindu Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am your host, Dean Accardi, and today we are discussing Gil Ben-Harout's new and exciting book, Shiva's Saints, The Origins of Devotion in Kannada, according to Harihara's Ragaleglu, published in 2018 by Oxford University Press. A scholarly masterpiece, Shiva's Saints provides theoretical insight into sainthood, the politics of commemoration, and the contentious worlds of ever-changing religious and other social identity formations through a close examination of the text and contexts of Harihara's Ragaleglu, a 12th century hagiographical text in Kannada that extols the lives of the early Veerashaiva saints in ways distinct from how they are commemorated in later hagiographical texts, especially the most well-known 16th century Shunya Sampadane. In my conversation with author Gil Ben-Harout, we discuss the multiple goals of hagiographical literature, as well as the complications and complexities around what the Veerashaivas are most well known for, their bhakti, or inner devotion to Shiva, their egalitarianism, and their challenging of Brahmanical norms. We also delve into the nuances of the social worlds in which Harihara was embedded and to which his Ragaleglu is responding, most especially who Harihara casts as distinct but familial others versus those intimate others who should be kept out of the community. Without further ado, let us now turn to my recent interview with Gil Ben-Harout. Hello, Gil. Welcome to New Books in Hindu Studies. It's a pleasure to be interviewing you and a great pleasure to have read your excellent book. But before we jump into the content of your book, Shiva's Saints, I would first like to ask you a more biographical question. How did you come to this field of study? And what is your story of becoming a scholar? How did you come to focus on this specific topic of your book?
Hi, Dean. And thank you for having me on this wonderful program. So my kind of personal biographical background begins with me being Israeli in my origins and like many Israelis after the army in the early 20s who go backpacking in India, I was one of them. And I was deeply impressed and moved by India in general on its many levels. And when I decided to kind of pursue professional career, it was almost an obvious choice to seek that this area of India studies. In Israel, luckily, this field is pretty much very developed. And we have some luminaries, David Shulman, Igal Bronner, and others, and just a wonderful incubator for India studies on different levels. So I started there, and maybe a little bit moving forward into the project that brought forth this book, Shiva's Saints. I had two moments during my master's in Israel before moving to the U.S. For my PhD studies, where I took a decision to delve deeply into Kannada culture or pre-modern literature. One of these two moments was when I started working with H.V. Nagaraja Rao, who visited Israel and worked with Israeli scholars on Sanskrit. He's a wonderful Sanskritist, a wonderful person in general. I also visited him in Mysore, Karnataka, which is the region in which Kannada is spoken. So that introduction to Kannada culture as a lived tradition was really new to me, coming from Sanskrit and the really textual studies and culture into a living culture. And just to be acquainted with this vast literary culture of a regional language, living language, was a delight for me. And then there was a second moment during that period of my master's when I came across A.K. Ramanujan's Speaking of Shiva, this very famous book, very popular in introduction classes to Hinduism and to devotional religion. It's a translation of poems called Vachana poetry, which was written in Kannada in the early centuries of the second millennium. It captivated me, the religious vision, this liberal, lyrical language so long ago, 800 years ago, really touched me. I was intrigued by these Shaivas, and the stories about their lives fascinated me. So that was the direction I was aiming for when I moved to the U.S. And started my PhD at Emory University at the Graduate Division of Religion there. During the early moments of my PhD studies at Emory, I went back and forth to Karnataka, to India, to work on my Kannada, and I almost accidentally came across this particular text, which is the center of this book. It's written by a poet called Harihara, and it's generally called, the text is called Ragalegalu, or in its fuller name, Shiva Sharanara Ragalegalu, which could be translated as Ragale Poems for Shiva's Saints. I said I came across it by chance because I was working on a particular story of a saint, a Shaiva saint from the Kannada regions around the 12th century. It's a very peculiar story. The saint is told to, he's said to have beheaded his own head, decapitated himself, during a wager with a Jain, a member of another religion, at a temple ground. So they had a wager over the temple. And this Shaiva saint won the contest by reconnecting his head and surviving this ordeal. What intrigued me especially was the historical resonances, because the temple was there. The sword or the knife that he used to sever his head is there. The inscription is there. So there is a kind of a very historical mode of presenting a story, which is obviously fantastic. And I was intrigued by this, by the complications of this. And I was looking for early sources when I came across Harihara's version of this story that no one worked with. So there was one inscription, there was another early source translated to English. Harihara's version was never dealt with in English scholarship, and he had a lot to say, in the sense that his version was very different than the others. So that kind of drew my attention to this fantastic corpus called the Ragalegalu, the Saint Stories by Harihara, to which my monograph, Shiva's Saints, is dedicated.
Thank you for that, Gil. There's much more to the story than I had known before, so I appreciate your telling us more about how you came to this topic of study. The first question I'd like to ask you with regard to the book, and you started mentioning this in your response to the last question, is that there appears to be a lot of thought that you have put into the title of your book, Shiva's Saints, The Origins of Devotion in Kannada, according to Harihara's Ragalegalu, with specific words being carefully chosen to engage a number of pressing debates in particular ways. Could you explain the title in the context of the arguments you are making in your book and the larger goals and objectives you wish to achieve through the book? And how does Harihara's Ragalegalu serve as a means by which to address these larger issues?
Sure, Dean. Interestingly enough, when I came to think about the title of the book, it sort of appeared rather naturally, having written the book. But the fact that you presented it as effectively addressing some of the major themes makes it a good way of kind of introducing what I'm doing in this book. So the main title of the book is Shiva's Saints, and I'm using the term saints as a translation of a Kannada word, which is used to refer to these 12th century figures. The word is Sharana, and this is how they are familiar, how they're known in the Kannada landscape, as the Sharanas of the 12th century, the refuge seekers of God, of the God Shiva. So by calling it the book Shiva's Saints, I'm immediately addressing the fact that I work with these figures in a broader category of the saint, which is admittedly a discourse in religious studies that grows out of Christianity, right? The saint. I am using it in an analytical manner, and I explain in my book why I chose to call them, to term them, to address them as saints. On the onset, we can say that saints immediately focuses our readings of these Shaiva figures through the lens of a life story, which is edified. It immediately generates questions about how we read hagiographies, and I hope to say a little bit more about that later on in the interview. The subtitle of the book, The Origins of Devotion in Kannada, really touches on an entrenched conversation, an ongoing, sometimes even heated debate on how the Shaiva devotional tradition began in the Kannada-speaking region. Maybe a few words of introduction. This tradition today is known as the Virashaiva or Lingayat, the Virashaivas, the Lingayats of the Karnataka states. It's a collection of different communities. Some of them are very impressively self-confident, well-organized, very present in the political, social, economical landscape of Karnataka today. Some of them own a lot of the colleges, and they kind of well presented in today's society in Karnataka. Part of the conversation about Virashaivas today, and I'm using Virashaiva instead of Lingayat just for terms of practicality. Part of the discussion about Virashaivas today is directly linked to the memory of the early Sharanas, the early saints of the 12th century, the Vachana poetry that is attributed to them, kind of becomes, or it's this memory and this poetry is invoked many times when talking about the here and now of the Virashaivas in Karnataka. I should briefly mention that the Virashaivas are kind of have their own distinct set of practices and religious and social identity. They carry a small emblem of the god Shiva, which is the linga that they carry on their body and they worship on their left hands. They do not cremate their dead as the kind of general, the general practices of Hinduism, but they bury them. Widows are allowed to remarry. There are all kind of very distinct practices and communal formations. The political debate around Virashaivas today in Karnataka, which is something that I'm not directly dealing with in my book, takes on different directions. In the recent elections last year, there was a huge push. I think it passed to declare Veerashaivism as a separate religion, as a religious minority, separate from Hinduism. So they are definitely in the front line of today's society. The 12th century saints are indeed in the contemporary debates, the 12th century saints are invoked to give a kind of a historical hold to the claims of today's communities. And this is why there is such an interest in how those saints lived. What did they proclaim? What did they teach? What were their values? And so on and so forth in contemporary conversations. Now, when I, as a scholar, you know, when I approach this big question mark of the 12th century, I'm my kind of the initial step I'm taking is asking, well, how do we know what we know about these figures? What are the sources that we turn to, that we read, that we kind of pass on from one generation to another, and or discover? And the kind of initial this initial question brought somewhat surprising answers, because in kind of hard historical terms, there are very little sources, contemporary sources, about the 12th century. We do have a lot of inscriptions that involve local kings and rulers and battles and temple consecrations, but very scant material which directly addresses the what we call today the Veerashaiva, those Shaiva devotees, those Shaivas of the 12th century. Just to give a concrete example, the earliest inscription of the most prominent figure associated with the 12th century, who is Vasavana, is produced only a century later, in the middle of the 13th century. So we find it hard to kind of lay out a fixed or stable history if we address the kind of expected sources of hard evidence. Instead of that, we turn to literature, and here also there is a distinction to be made between the Vachanas, which I mentioned earlier. The Vachanas, this vast, ever-growing corpus of lyrical poetry. These are short poems. Many of them are striking for many reasons, but as I mentioned before, they are they're amazing. Reading the Vachanas involves some kind of a spiritual engagement. They have a very succinct, penetrating way of putting out perennial issues of belief, of metaphysical realities, also of society. They're very compelling in that sense. But if we are trying to pinpoint and understand historical processes of the 12th century by reading the Vachanas, we face very concrete problems. The first one is the exact lyrical nature of the Vachanas. They have very little to say in terms of context of who met who when, or what were the events that happened during the production of those Vachanas. The Vachanas themselves are very bare and abstract. There are other issues with the Vachanas that make their historical use problematic. They were orally transmitted for two or three centuries before written down for the first time in the 15th century. And when they were collected and written down, there is clear evidence that it was done with a very specific kind of ideology in mind, or several ideologies. There is a multivocality to the Vachanas, which means that people of different perceptions of the early tradition would invoke or quote a Vachana, just pick and choose the Vachana that will serve your own ideological stance. And so there is a plethora of approaches, ideologies in the Vachana corpus. So, which makes a kind of the scholar's work of trying to process these into a vision, into a stance, something of a maybe impossible mission. So this is one very prominent group of texts that is oftentimes used in an uncritical manner to talk about the 12th century. A third group of sources are the literature, what I call written literature, which is can be distinguished from Vachanas in that it's first of all, it was written in its production. It follows meter. It's elaborate. It's extensive, and it's highly descriptive. Much of this literature is narrative, meaning that it's exactly invested in conveying social events. I'm not going right now into the question of history or not. I will get to it a bit later. But there is a lot of material that can be worked out of these literary sources. And Harihara's Ragalegalu was the first narrative account of the 12th century saints. And it was written fairly early, probably around the early 13th century, meaning only a few decades after the purported events of the saints. By that, it gives us an access, maybe not to the 12th century, but it gives us a kind of a cultural snapshot of how these saints were understood very soon after their actions in the early 13th century, which I found intriguing. It's also an incredibly clear account of the saints. There is a clear sense that Harihara wants to describe each saint, the birth, the life, the events, the significances, and then he moves on to another saint and another saint. So there is a kind of very inviting quality to the Ragalegalu, which I was happy to embrace. And this is what this work is about.
Thank you. Yeah, so one of the things that I also found intriguing in your book is that there are a number of different ways of in which you have read Harihara's Ragalegalu. In addition to identifying it as a hagiography, which I would like you to address, you evaluate it as literature, as a devotional aid, as a product of particular social and political contexts, or as a prescriptive text aiming to normalize Harihara's particular interpretation over other possible narratives of these saints. So these different reading practices have a kind of profound impact on your ability to generate different insights into the text. So in regard to this, I have three interrelated questions. First, what is the significance of identifying this text as hagiography? Then, how do you navigate these different reading practices, and how do they generate different insights into the devotional and sociopolitical implications of the Ragalegalu?
Right. So, indeed, when I started reading the Ragalegalu, it was very early on. It became clear to me that I need to develop some reading strategies, some ways for meaning making of these stories. And the more I kind of delved into it, kind of a bigger analytical creature developed. But I think it's good to start with this text as hagiography. What is hagiography, right? It's a writing of saints' lives. Again, it's an analytical category I'm employing here, borrowed from a different tradition, Western European. But I would argue that this text works well when we examine it as a hagiography. Hagiography is, in general terms, is a particular kind of a mythical text, right? Any myth in whatever form is a text that tries to shape our contemporary attitudes and worldviews. whether it's false or true, whether it succeeds or not, it aims for this very intense influence on us, the readers. And I would argue that hagiography is a particular intense form of making tight claims about the intended audience of the hagiography, which are the religious communities who are intended to read it. So hagiography is a text that meant to shape people's lives and people's experiences according to a certain religious paradigm. And by that, it maintains such close relationships with its audience, with the need to appeal to them, that it's very easy to contextualize or to see the relationship between the text and its context in the hagiography. We can also think about hagiography in formal terms. It's a narrative that is patterned, right? It follows certain motifs that are repeated in many of the stories. So many times we have the prenatal and the posthumous career of the saints, which oftentimes shed light on what he did on earth. And we also usually get a certain clear purpose for the saint's existence on earth, something which is explicitly argued sometimes and is of value for us. In terms of the events of the narrative during the saint's life, right, we will probably read about miracles on one hand, and then on the other hand, highly realistic social context, right? So this mixture of miracles and realism begs some kind of an interpretive framework. Also, in general, hagiographies are rich with religious content. For example, rituals. How are rituals performed? How they were constituted following a particular event associated with a certain saint's life. All this makes a very fertile ground for excavating cultural knowledge. And I think it applies very well in the case of Harihara, or at least I try to make a case for it. At the same time, we're obviously not reading history, right? We're reading, like I said before, a cultural snapshot, a window to the attitudes, values, dispositions, concerns, anxieties of certain parts of a culture in a particular moment in history. And that forces us to develop a sophisticated reading strategy, which you address too in your question. So multiple strategies of reading and how to navigate between these different readings of the Ragalegalu. I mean, I have to say, kind of, you know, as a disclaimer, the way I interpret the Ragalegalu, or the multiple ways I interpret it, all should be regarded as an interpretation of a text. It's an argument about the text that can be supported. It can be convincing, and it's also given to debate and to rethinking. But once we approach the question of reading through the lens of interpretation, we can point to certain criteria that or tools that assist us in developing interpretation of the text as a whole, of a particular saint's lives or particular episodes within one saint's life story. So those tools, I think foremostly, is the issue of being sensitive to textural or textural markers, right? The word texture is of importance here, and I'm borrowing it from an important work by Subramaniam Narayana Rao and Shulman from this milieu, basically that calls to develop sensibilities to the text in its myriad facets, right? So attention to lexical choices, attention to authorial voice, a special attention to shifts in the tone of the author in the shift of the description, which is from description to narrative progression. We can move forward to how the narrative itself progresses. There are stylistic issues of weight in this process. So all these elements are incredibly rich and useful if we want to develop an argument about the text. These are operate within the text, but we have also a context, which is, I think, in the most concrete sense, it's the literary context of the work. So, you know, I turn in my work to examine the literary culture out of which, or maybe against which, Harihara is writing Deragalegalu. And I also turn to look at similar Shaiva texts that were produced in South India around the same time, maybe a little bit earlier in Tamil Nadu, in the Andhra regions of Telugu. Developments that indicate not only a concrete historical contact, which is of value in itself, but also help us to examine a broader reference of an imaginaire. Right, imaginaire, this kind of broad system of symbols, of stories, of literary figures that keep on popping in different texts, maybe in different ways, maybe for making different arguments, but they are nevertheless shared in an intertextuality that begs certain interpretations. And the last point I want to make in answering your question is the what kind of insights we can find or develop from applying multiple strategies of readings, and they are equally diverse and apply to different areas of life. So, for example, all this is very abstract, but I'm going to try and give something concrete. So, if we're reading a saint's story and suddenly Harihara goes into a long passage describing ritual action, right, choice of flowers and then bringing them to the image of the god and a certain worship with incense and lamp or a certain way of dressing up and so on and so forth. That level of detail suggests that maybe he's doing or he's offering a prescription, a ritual prescription to the immediate audience, sort of a pedagogical educational use, which is, I think, is a fairly direct way of reading those specific ritual passages. But then if we turn elsewhere in the text and the same saint would be described doing something very extreme, right? Maybe an extreme act of violence, either to himself or to his surrounding people, but some kind of an extreme action. Well, here, to read it in a prescription sense doesn't make much sense, right? There are stories, famous stories, stories that are very popular and beloved by these communities about a devotee who gouges out his own eye to give it to the god, or a loving couple who sacrificed their own son, beloved son, to the god. And we can't read these as prescriptions. It doesn't make sense that whole communities, normative communities existing till today, were eagerly learning about how to cook their own children. I don't think so, although I wouldn't preclude the possibility of such readings, extreme readings, at the margins of society. But I think in the mainstream sense, we're dealing with something else. We're not dealing with a prescription. We're switching to a different role of the text, which is maybe more edifying, maybe meant to generate a certain piety, a certain kind of emotional response, which is deep for the readers, definitely not literal. And then another element of the text and another reading strategy is to locate the silences of the text, the passages that are clearly reactionary to certain realities. Maybe I'll give here an example to make this concrete. Harihara writes about several saints involved in interreligious marriages. And he's obviously not happy with that. All these stories end up with some kind of cataclysm, right? Some kind of mass violence, mass conversion, particularly of a religious group that is opponent to the adversary to the Shaivas, which are the Jains. I'll talk about them later on. But so the point I'm making is that Harihara is clearly writing against something which is of a major concern to him and maybe by implication to his intended audience. So we can certainly see Harihara, we can hear Harihara tells us, do not engage in interreligious marriages. But what we can extract from this very loud voice is a more basic admittance that they are an issue. That interreligious marriages, as much as he's not happy about them, are a real concern. So in fact, those kind of reactionary moments or silences of Harihara are the most significant in historical lens.
Thank you. You touched upon a key part that I noticed in your text, which is about this question of kind of being an example versus being an exemplar. I think you cite Jack Hawley as one of the people that gave this framework. And yet you kind of move beyond just these two options, but also find other ways of interpreting or understanding what is at stake in these stories for Harihara. So this moves me to kind of thinking about the next few chapters in your books. In chapter two, you analyze Harihara's depiction of the interiority of the saints, kind of the inner devotional lives of these bhaktas. Whereas in chapters three and four, you address the external social worlds of the saints, first engaging the kind of often discussed egalitarianism of these religious traditions, and then engaging the kind of specific rules and practices of this religious community that are often understood as breaking normative Brahmanical practices, such as the consumption of meat, or as you mentioned before, the kind of burial instead of cremation or these other sorts of practices. So in regards to these, both the interiority of the saints as well as the kind of external social worlds, I was wondering, how do you interpret these three aspects of the saints' lives in Harihara's Ragaleglu, this interior devotion, the egalitarianism, and the challenging of normative practices? How do they interface with each other, and what are the deeper implications of your analysis of them?
Sure. I organized, when I sat down to write the book, I decided to organize it thematically, right? Presenting these different realms of interpretation or relation to the Ragaleglu according to a certain movement, starting from the interiority of the bhakta, the devotee, as he or she is prescribed in the Ragaleglu, and then moving outward into social interaction within the community of devotees, and then beyond with religious others and political entities surrounding the community. So really, if we were looking for something that we can identify as a common thread in a really bewildering plethora of stories about a very diverse cadre of saints, we have some preliminary we have a very basic problem because how can we connect a kind of a potter who is working on his pots in his backyard? How can we connect him with a mystic who renounces society, or with a minister at a king's court who counts money for him? What is the connecting thread? And I think what comes out when reading the Ragaleglu stories in all their diversity is that these figures are emotionally invested in devotion to the god Shiva in a very uncompromising way. We could mention other traditions in comparison. Not all of them are as extreme in their devotional zeal as this tradition. Other traditions are. definitely the Tamil Shaivas, which are, again, interrelated, interconnected with this tradition, the Nayanmars, are similar in that regard. But within the Ragalegalu, you find very clear evidence that the emotional quality is of major importance to Harihara. He uses these terms to describe emotions of devotion, such as Bahaya Bhakti, right? Bahaya Bhakti, it's a dvandva, it's a compound of two words. Bhakti, we kind of regularly understand as devotion. Bahaya is a little bit more problematic. Bahaya is usually translated in negative terms as terrible, as fearful. But if we see Bhaya Bhakti, if we examine where it's invoked in Harihara's text, we see that it oftentimes is invoked in moments of piety when the saint meets his or her God. So there is a kind of a sense of awe and devotion, right? This kind of centrality of the emotive condition of the saint in those moments, and it's shared across the stories. A similar term that is ubiquitous in the text is yeka nishte, right? Yeka nishte, single-minded dedication. To who? To the god Shiva. And indeed, these stories present us with figures who are single-minded. They are immersed in their devotion to the god. They are non-reflective. You see many times that their actions are not don't take into account any consequences. They are immediate in their action in the world. And I think that also works very well with Harihara's own voice, which is personal, which is emotional, with a lot of exclamation marks. So this inner devotion is a wonderful starting point, I think, to kind of connect figures who are very different in the way they understand the god, in the way they worship the god. Moving to touch on this issue of egalitarianism, which is indeed very, very common in today's discussions about Virashaivas, right? So some promulgators of the tradition in some forms of the tradition today kind of look back at the 12th century saints as egalitarians par excellence. Words like democratic, gender equal are often invoked in order to make contemporary arguments. And indeed, one cannot deny the centrality of egalitarian notions in the Ragalegalu, right? There is a term for it that Harihara invokes, samashile, right? Equal conduct, equal etiquette. But once we read the stories from close, we see how this ideal of egalitarianism is qualified and problematized in important ways. So for one, egalitarianism in the stories is only present when we're talking about a religious framework, in a tight religious framework. Only when there is ritual action, involves several devotees, this principle of equal conduct is invoked. Where it's not a concern for Harihara is the social condition of the devotees outside of religious belief. He also shows very little interest. In fact, he shows only antagonism to those who are not Shaivas. So if we're talking about egalitarianism, it's a very different sort of egalitarianism that we consider today in contemporary parlance, in a strictly social sense. Another element that qualifies this egalitarianism in the early period are the real-life constraints that those Shaivas encounter in the stories. So, for example, women who are indeed receive a lot of agency in this tradition in general, and in this particular in these particular stories, much more than in the kind of, you know, imagined Brahminical male-centered authority, however we wish to read it or imagine it. At the same time, women are bounded by their roles as women in society. So Akka Mahadevi, which is surely the most famous female figure among the early saints and in general, and wonderful poetess of Vachana poetry, when she walks out on her husband in the Ragalegalu because of him not being an ardent Shaiva, her only resort is to renunciation. She is not reintegrated into society in the way that she was before the marriage. So she pays a price, in other words, for her devotion. Similarly, work, which is completely exonerated by Harihara from any sense of Brahminical impurity, right, applied to kind of low caste professions, which is a wonderful, has a wonderful correspondence with modern values. At the same time, this focus on legitimizing labor and specific work identities really minimizes the possibility of social mobility, of changing one's profession, which is really never arise in these stories, understandably in their historical context. So egalitarianism, yes, but with, I think, very important qualification added to it. Lastly, I want to relate to this question of Harihara's approach to the resistance to normative Brahminical mainstream practices, a resistance that is usually attributed or identified with Virashaivism in general. And again, we cannot deny reading those stories that there is an antipathy towards any kind of codified ritualistic mode of living, in favor, of course, of devotional sentiments. But to say that the Ragalegalu presents a vision which is anti-Brahminical or anti-temple worship in the manner that the early tradition is understood today by some is a radical misreading of the text. So temple is ubiquitous and very positively presented in the Ragalegalu, a contrast to very famous Vachanas, often quoted in scholarship. Even Brahminical practices, of course, Brahminism in the sense of social exclusion is intolerable by Harihara because of that ritual Shaiva ritual arena, which is egalitarian. He cannot stand those claims for impurity invoked by certain Brahmins. At the same time, he does defend some Brahminical practices, such as vegetarianism. There is a sense of legitimizing Brahminical elite as an elitist class, as an elite class. So Brahmins operate at the king's court, including good Shaiva saints. There is nothing wrong about it. They are educated, and so on and so forth. The moment where Harihara puts a stop to Brahminical identity is once, as I said before, it steps on practices of other communities. So if another Shaiva wishes to worship Shiva through meat consumption, which is something, again, intolerable within Brahminism, Harihara definitely will legitimize it. But what we get from this is a very complicated social picture, right? So we have this legitimization of Brahmins here and legitimization of heterodox or transgressive practices on the other hand, and there are different ways of worshiping Shiva, and they're not always commensurate with each other. So what I'm arguing is that Harihara is in fact trying to appeal to different communities and in different ways. And this is a very different way of thinking about the early tradition if we compare it with this kind of notion of Virashaivism, a very bounded sect with very clear set of practices and do's and do nots. There are real life complexities in the Ragalegalu, and they are very apparent, and we need to address these.
Thank you for that. I especially appreciate how you point out that even for Harihara, there's a sense of, okay, there are the saints, there is our community, but there are other Shaiva communities, and these chapters address these kind of relationships or how he handles kind of internal interactions amongst Shaivas. And this is in contrast to what you address in chapters 5 and 6, where you shift your focus from how Harihara handles the interior lives and the social interactions amongst these Shaiva saints and devotees to how Harihara engages two distinct kinds of social others. First, the non-Shaiva royalty and Vaishnava Brahmins in the royal court, and second, the Jains, whom you describe as the intimate holy other. How and why does Harihara distinguish these two groups of others, and what do you find to be the significance of these distinct otherings?
Well, maybe I should begin with kind of a quick remark about the relation of Harihara to royalty, right? There is a huge lacuna in our knowledge about the history of the region. We know something about the kings and kind of meaningful events in their lives. We don't really know how these courts operated in any historical manner, although some good work is being done, I think, these days, and it is promising. But in general, what we do find in Harihara is antipathy and rejection of court life. It's a worldly arena, right? When in this tradition, a non-Shaiva is called Bhavi, a worldling, right? And the king is embodiment of worldly power, and as such, he's immediately suspicious for Harihara. And then on the other hand, we see repeated consistent interest in the court by Harihara. Many of his saints operate at the court. In fact, they feel comfortable to some extent at the court. They're especially good in counting money, for example. So we have a complicated picture here of sort of imagining the court as a resource, a very useful resource for the betterment of the Shaivas, but at the same time, a place which is negative by its very nature of being non-committed to Shaiva devotion. Moving to discuss the religious others of the Ragalegalu, you asked about the how I'm approaching this question and why. How can we explain this religious othering? And I think the how is easier to discuss than the why, right? So the how the religious others are discussed in the text is pretty apparent. And people noted that this tradition is very explicit in its antagonizing of other religions, but no one really delved into the relationships and what can be assumed from these stories. I think in general, the issue of religious other is of major importance today, right? It applies to India in general and the challenges it faces regarding different religious communities in politics and in society. It has a particular sense in Karnataka with a local very ancient Jain community with Muslims, and it also applies in a kind of a broader sense. Religious other is an important ingredient in what constitutes Hinduism, in whatever way we wish to think about it. So there is a lot to be said here, but I will only say very quickly. So reading the stories of the Sharanas in Harihara's text, one encounters two distinct groups of religious others. One are the Vaishnavas, Brahmins, always located at the court, right? Always these high officials. And then the Jains, who everywhere but at the court. They're at the temple, they're at markets, they're at the house, right? They are implicated in interreligious marriages that I mentioned earlier with Shaivas. So first of all, there is a very clear typology in the stories between the Vaishnavas, who are ministers, and the Jains, who are merchants, who are worshippers of their own kind. And then the treatment of these two separate groups is very different again. So Harihara, although the Vaishnavas are derided by him, they are accommodated in the stories. They are, there is always a hope of convincing them, of showing them the greatness of the Shaiva faith. There are some acknowledged shared cultural background to the Vaishnava Brahmins and the Shaivas, you know, the Agamas, the Vedas, in whatever. They don't need to be taken in the same sense, but they are shared between these groups. The Jains are projected in this text as something completely different. They are completely alien or alienated, right? They have nothing that can be accommodated with. They, in the end of most stories, they are either annihilated in large number, paradigms, 8,000 Jains are killed, or they are converted en masse to Shaivism. So it's a very different treatment of these two groups. And at the same time, there is something which is a little bit paradoxical. The Vaishnava Brahmins located at the court have a very limited hold, very limited engagement with Shaivas. It's only at the court around political intrigues, around money distributions and getting the king's patronage, which kind of puts them in a very elitist, distinct, separated realm from day-to-day Shaiva encounters. The Jains, on the other hand, as can be already, as I already implied to earlier, are met everywhere, right? So when the Shaiva goes, he overhears a Jaina at the market. He argues with a Jain at the temple. And the worst case from Harihara's point of view is that they marry each other. And there must be a certain amount of shared cultural life to be had between these two groups. In other words, if a Shaiva married Jaina and the text complains about that, we must assume, at least in the minds of the intended audience, a certain acceptance of shared rituals, such as the marriage rituals, shared practices, such as cooking together, maybe worship, maybe clothes. So all these elements shows that, in fact, this very harsh antagonizing of Jains might indicate closer relationships and maybe even mingling among communities, which Harihara tried to argue against. So to go back to the larger question of the religious other in the Ragalegalu, what are the significances? Well, first of all, what we see in the Ragalegalu complicates any simplified readings of conflict between the communities in history. And we do find that. It is a matter of fact that many of the Jain temples in Karnataka were converted into Shaivism. It's not clear in what manner. Was it a violent conversion, a forced one, or rather a kind of communal volitionary evolution or change? Those are very complicated answers. I do not attempt even to provide a hermetic answer. On the contrary, I want to complicate this idea of understanding the religious history or interreligious conflict in the region by this the reading that I just offered. And second point, which is also applicable to today, religious identities are complex. They're flexible. They change. They are interactional, contextual, and they measured in different distances from others at a given context. So that's a lesson that I think we need to take with us for today as well.
Thank you, Gil. I appreciate such in your book having such kind of rich and nuanced and kind of sensitive approaches and interpretations to such a kind of rarely examined part of this tradition and writings about this tradition. And I sincerely hope that many people, both in the academic world as well as everyday people in South Asia and elsewhere, end up reading your book, because I think it can have profound impacts on these contemporary debates. As you note, that there's brought forward many arguments out of this, out of reading certain texts from the tradition as to how society should be shaped today. So my next question for you, though, is then, you know, how do you see or hope this book contributes to the kind of either the broader literature and emerging scholarship on kind of the devotional traditions, or even these kind of current political debates that are happening around these traditions and how they should be approached and considered and situated in the world today?
Perhaps I should start with saying something general about Kannada scholarship. Kannada culture, literature is commonly, frequently acknowledged in scholarship today as a highly rich and varied universe. We're talking about an ongoing literary production of at least 15 centuries. We have access to most of that literature, and equally important is the modern production of Kannada literature, which is exceptionally successful, even if we measure it in terms of the number of Kannada poets and authors who receive national recognition in India today. So we're dealing here with a wonderful, rich, incredibly rich, complicated culture, and which is almost in an opposite way treated in scholarship today as neglected. And there are probably historical reasons for this that we cannot go into all of them. I mean, it's enough to think about Karnataka in the colonial period, right? Area without a major port outside of India. one of those early moments that kind of maybe shaped the way that we are working with India, interfacing with India through scholarship today. Those ways need to be developed further. In a very concrete sense, we need to train more scholars in Kannada language and literature and culture. One huge step towards this is the AAAS Kannada Language Program, the American Institute for Indian Studies, in which I studied. I took my advanced Kannada year and was crucial for my work. So yes, and more. We need more. Now, to talk specifically about my work in terms of the scholarship about Kannada, my book focuses on a particularly intriguing moment, I would argue, in Kannada literature, right? There is this 12th, 13th century, the appearance of the Vachana and then the Ragalegalu, and then additional literature clearly marks a shift in literary practices of the region. Radical shift, one would say, from focus on courtly literary production, which has tight links to kings, which is very intricate in its style, which builds directly from the kind of pan-Indian Sanskritic, cosmopolitan Sanskrit, is famously argued by Sheldon Pollock. And we have in this moment of the 12th, 13th century, rise, appearance of something else, something that's much more attuned to Deshi, to local literature, local language, local meters. The themes are different. The forms are different. So I hope this book will encourage people to take a closer look into Kannada with kind of literary sensibilities to historical changes over time. I think that's an exciting area. With specifically about the devotional culture that grew up and developed in the Kannada-speaking region, definitely not limited to Shaivism, with much more exciting realms like the Haridasa Sahitya and others. It's such a prolific universe. People should just read more texts. Just go learn Kannada, pick up texts, broaden, expand the canvas of what we know today. And I think the potential for discoveries is almost endless if we think about it. In terms of the implication of my work to political debates today, I make no claims. I think the political debates today in Karnataka about Veerashaivism and related issues have their own logic, and they have their own history, and we should accept it. We should definitely engage with it, but notice its own trajectories. So I'm not making any direct claims about today, except for one, and that is to really encourage and urge people in Karnataka, people who are Kannadigas, to read more of their own pre-modern literature. I think there is a general incorrect even a cliche that pre-modern Kannada is hard to read by modern Kannada speakers. And I think that's utterly wrong. I think it's not that different, and it's definitely exciting and promising. It's definitely not boring. My only claim about the contemporary politics and societies, Karnataka, is just a general call to see the complex historical picture by paying attention to what is out there and develop a nuanced approach, which I think is what we in the academy are ultimately invested in, right? We're invested in generating, encouraging, enhancing nuance.
Thank you. And thank you again for this incredible book. I sincerely hope that it is widely read and has the kind of impact and generates the kind of nuanced, sensitive understandings of the past and the present that you are hoping for. Now that you have completed this monumental work, what other projects do you have in the works, or what new projects are on the horizon for you? If you were to predict, what do we have to look forward to from you in the future?
Well, thank you for this question. I mean, one project that I'm already working on is translating the Ragalegalu, or selections from the Ragalegalu, as a separate publication from this book, right? I think disconnected from the book, or not disconnected in relation, but with some kind of independence. The stories themselves are fantastic, fascinating, rich, entertaining, I really want to complete a translation that will be available in English. I'm working on that, collaborating with my Kannada teacher in Mysore, RVS Sundaram. And we're addressing a completely different set of questions in the translation than what I had in the monograph. This project is supported by the American Academy of Religions Collaborative Research Award, which I'm thankful for, and hopefully it will be out sometime soon without committing to a certain moment. In addition to that, I'm curious about studying bhakti, devotional traditions in India, but from a cross-regional perspective, right? This is such an exciting moment in scholarship where different scholars work on different areas in India with the lens of devotion, and they are coming up with such different picture and different understanding. So together with my colleague, John Coyne, we established the Regional Bhakti Scholars Network, and we're having an annual symposia. We're about to roll out an edited volume about bhakti from different regional perspectives. And we're also developing a database that will be open to the public and present different scholarship of bibliography of sources about bhakti from different traditions in a way that will allow us to do cross-examinations of themes, histories, literature, and so on. I have other projects, like because of my past as a programmer, I developed a platform for rapid online searches in dictionaries, something that I think is very much required in regional languages of India. With our limited resources, we can scan and make searchable so many lexicons and dictionaries. It's something that I'm developing separately. Another project is to continue for another monograph, research monograph, that will build on this one, on Shiva saints. But this time, continuing to reading Shaiva text, I'm interested in taking a diachronic approach and addressing questions of historical development in this tradition in different moments of its history, 12th century, 15th century, 18th century, and others, which I think is an exciting project to take on.
Thank you. I very much look forward to seeing these various projects you are working on come out and being able to utilize them as much as I can. And thank you once again for accepting the invitation to speak to us here. And I wish you the best in the time ahead.
Well, thank you, Dean, so much for this wonderful interview and initiative. All the best.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New Books in Hindu Studies podcast. I have been your host, Dean Akardi, and today we have been discussing Shiva's saints, the origins of devotion in Kannada according to Harihara's Ragaleglu by Gil Ben Harut. I greatly enjoyed this book and highly recommend you obtain a copy of your own if you haven't already. I hope you enjoyed listening to our discussion today, and I look forward to you joining us again for our next New Books in Hindu Studies podcast.